negatively affected because this new military commissions bill basically allows you to be convicted on coerced evidence and secret evidence that you don't ever have a right to confront. The Eighth Amendment, cruel and human degrading treatment and punishment is gone away if the president can authorize people to be tortured at will. I mean, all this is happening, and it's resulting in, I hate to say it, but a truly fundamentally different country than we've had for the last 200-plus years.
Mark Babawi co-produces The Monitor on KPFT in Houston. For Informed Dissent, I'm Robert Knight in New York.
Informed Dissent is produced by the Pacifica Foundation and community stations all over the country. This segment was produced by Robert Knight. Executive producer is Otis McClay. Technical direction by John L. Mella and Elise. Mushroom Cloud Theater is written by David Dozer and performed by him and Janet Coleman. Original music is produced, written, and performed by Sean Rhodes. Remember, it's listeners like you who make shows like this possible, so please support your local community radio station during Fund Drive. For Informed Dissent, I'm Mitch Jezrich in New York.
That's it for Sprouts. You've been listening to a segment of Informed Dissent, Pacifica's weekly election special. Sprouts is distributed and coordinated by the Pacifica Radio Network, thanks to Michael Yoshida at Satellite Operations. If you or someone at your station has a radio production that you wish to rebroadcast on Sprouts, contact our air traffic controller, Ursula Rudenberg, at ursula@pacifica.org. That's ursula@pacifica.org. You just heard this week's credits for Informed Dissent, produced by people from all over the country, just like Sprouts. I'm Otis McClay, executive producer of Informed Dissent. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week on Sprouts.
Coming up next on Free Radio Santa Cruz at 101.1 FM or freakradio.org. Yes, it's Bathurst Pier's Broadsides. Stay tuned for the next 2 hours, and we'll stay tuned with you. Today is November 9th, 2006.
Gets dry and you want to get high. I gotta clean them seeds just one more time. About booze. Now I sing about whatever I use.
Granny, won't you smoke some? Get cookies, we'll get high and do the boogie. Grand old smokes of a marriage you wanna. Smoke it out short and feed the roast. Grand old smokes of a marriage you wanna. For Nevada, Granny's out looking for some marijuana. Grand old smokes of marijuana. Dry him down on my knees. Get away, Granny, get away from me. Granny used to get high and listen to the Beatles. Ain't as much fun now that it's legal. Grand old smokes of marijuana.
And that, of course, was Granny Won't You Smoke from a bizarre collection of pot songs from an anomalous source. You're tuned to Free Radio, as mentioned before, 101.1 FM and freakradio.org. I'm Robert Norris. Be with you for the next 2 hours. At 7:30, we hope to have calling in attorney Ben Rice, who is handling the case of Roger Minch, the man accused of selling medical marijuana to medical marijuana patients in Santa Cruz County. A serious crime indeed, for which he's facing his second trial. He was convicted on one count. That count was overturned recently by the Court of Appeals, the District Court of Appeals. It was a state court. And then that has been reappealed to a higher court by the State Attorney General's Office, according to Ben Rice. We'll be talking to Ben about this case, about the county's strange policies, which apparently would hold the Greenway Medical Marijuana Dispensary a criminal enterprise if they had the power. In the studio with me is the much-abused and occasionally well-spoken Condor. Are you Condor tonight? Are you Gregarious Greg? Just what are you, sir?
Condor.
You are Condor. Actually, you're a member of SAFE, Society for Artistic Freedom and Expression. You've been known to lurk around the New Leaf Market area downtown on Pacific Avenue on Wednesday nights.
That's for sure.
I understand. When I was there last Wednesday, yesterday, it looked pretty tame, pretty dull. There wasn't much happening. Is SAFE essentially dying by the wayside after its 3-year run? Are we finally run out of SAFEsters?
I doubt it. However, people move on. They do other things. People change. People need a break. But there's others that take their place. And if nothing else, the Condor is still kicking it into high gear when he shows up.
Did you bring your guitar with you?
Yes, I did.
Are you going to bless us with a little music here, perhaps?
Yeah, perhaps. Perhaps if we can get the old fire burning.
Indeed. We'll see if we can light a little coal under you there.
Come on, baby, light my fire.
Sort of like that, yeah. Who knows? I may join in and hum along. If you're interested in proposing any particular numbers for a Condor to sing, you can always call in at 427-3772. That's the voice line here for Free Radio.
Is that number working?
I hope so. It looks like it's. I assume it's working. Let's take a. Well, I think so. I want you, Condor, to keep an eye on these two buttons here. If you see anything going flash, tell me, and
wow,
I will respond.
Amazing.
Yes, it's exciting. The technology here is quite overwhelming, particularly for one of my rudimentary skills. I am very limited. Anyway, what's happening? Well, we just had a local election, of course, a national election. The Fuhrer has lost his right-hand man.
Rumsfeld's out.
Rumsfeld is out, and the head of the CIA, the same guy who gave us Iran-Contra back in the 80s, is in again. That's Bill Gates.
All in the family.
Sort of the old, the the crazy imperialist crowd is out, the more prudent imperialist crowd is in. At least that's my view of the current situation. However, let me read you a couple of other views. Here's Bruce K. Gagnon. Gagnon, perhaps. He's on the Counterpunch website. He writes, "What's next for the peace movement? Confront the Democrats now." The Washington Post reported this morning that the Democratic Party's foreign policy establishment sees a precipitous withdrawal from Iraq as potentially damaging to both the country's and the party's interests. The battle is on. The new Speaker of the House of Representatives, Nancy Pelosi, is saying that the Dems will govern, quote, from the middle. Impeachment is not on the table, she recently said. Representative Rahm Emanuel, Democrat of Illinois, who led the effort on behalf of Democratic Party House candidates, is saying that they can't allow the party's liberal wing to dominate the agenda. The changes in Congress are largely due to huge opposition, 62%, to the U.S. occupation of Iraq. Again, quoting today's Washington Post, the passion of the anti-war movement helped propel party activists in this election year. How will the peace movement in America, that just turned itself nearly completely over to the Democratic Party, be rewarded for its loyalty? Many Democratic lawmakers have signed on to a vague plan for a phased withdrawal from Iraq, but the party remains divided between a base eager to get out soon and a foreign policy establishment that sees a precipitous withdrawal as potentially damaging to both the country's and the party's interests, the Washington Post concludes. Pelosi is already pointing to a, quote, bipartisan study group on Iraq that is co-chaired by Texas oil man and former Republican Secretary of State James Baker. Don't expect any surprises here. Most of the new Democratic Party gains in the House were conservative blue dog Democrats who do not support immediate withdrawal from Iraq. Instead, these new Dems, controlled by Bill Clinton's Democratic Leadership Council, the DLC, will steer the country on a basic status quo course. Their excuse will be, hey, we have a national election in 2 years, we want to take back the White House, so we have to go slow now so we don't alienate the public. My translation, the corporations will control the new Democratic Party Congress, and we see no real basic change. So what does the peace movement do now? We must continue to call for immediate withdrawal from Iraq. We must call for a 50% cut in military spending and conversion of the military-industrial complex. We must call for an end to Star Wars research and development funding, which now stands at about $10 billion a year. I suppose that's better than $10 billion a month for Iraq. We must call for investigations of Bush-Cheney for impeachable offenses. We must call for repeal of the Patriot Act and the recent Military Commissions Act, the torture bill, not to mention the amendments to the Insurrection Act, which allows the president to call up the National Guard at a snap of the fingers. We have to call out loudly and strongly for universal national health care and for new federal election laws that sets one national standard to ensure fair voting. There are many more things that must now be advanced by the peace, justice, environmental, labor, and women's movements, and we must be impatient with the Democrats. One last word here about liberal activists who supported the Dems, fully knowing that many of them have been supporting the funding for the occupation of Iraq.
Yep.
I disagreed with this strategy of knee-bending loyalty to a party that does not deserve such support, but it is done now. To these liberals, peace activists, I say this. Don't sell us all out now by going easy on the Dems. Don't tell us to wait. Give them a chance. Give them 2 years.
Nope.
Let them take back the White House before we demand too much from them. Don't sell yourself out. You have helped create this new Democratic Party control of Congress. Get off your knees now and demand that they do something. Force the Dems to respond to you. If you don't, you'll have to let down the long-suffering Iraqi people who are dying at the hands of U.S. military power. Don't let the GIs down who have died or suffered serious injury in Iraq for a war that was illegal in the first place. We must keep fighting harder than ever to bring this mad war to an end. The battle has just begun. Where will you stand? Bruce J. K. Gagnon, coordinator of the Global Network Against Weapons and Nuclear Power in Space. You can be reached at globalnet@mindspring.com. Your view, Condor?
Sounds pretty realistic. At the national level, it seems to me that the Republican and Democratic parties are just sharing different labels, but they're really the same in terms of their overall policy and direction. Seems like the people themselves, the grassroots, have to hold the Democratic leadership party's feet to the fire. If there's going to be any really substantive changes, it'll probably just, if we let it go as is, there'll be rhetorical talk about change. But really, if they get away with it, they'd rather just keep it the same. That's my opinion anyway. They'd rather just keep maintaining the corporatocracy, the plutocracy, basically. You mean I'm not loud enough?
Your volume is excellent. Your proximity to the microphone leaves something to be desired. There you go. Thank you. And do that again, will you please? You want to call in and give a kiss to Uncle Robert or possibly a salute here to Condor? You can, 427-3772. Also, note, if you do call in, turn down your radio. Otherwise, you may become confused, and we may be waiting for your next comment for the next 15 or 20 seconds, tapping our fingers impatiently. Again, the phone number, 427-3772. Here's another article, actually, that I just noticed by Lawrence E. Walsh. He was the independent counsel in the Iran-Contra investigation in the 80s, for those of us old-timers who remember it. This article is excerpted from his book, Firewall, The Iran-Contra Conspiracy and Cover-Up, and again, is on the Counterpunch website. It's about the change in, well, it's about Gates, the new Secretary of Defense designate, and presumably he'll be Robert Gates. He'll be approved by the Congress. It's called Lies, Cover-Ups, and Slanted Intelligence, Robert Gates and Iran-Contra. The day after Claire George's arraignment, we turned to Robert Gates. The Senate Intelligence Committee's hearings on his appointment to head the CIA were scheduled to begin within a few days. Craig Gullen and I, that's Lawrence Walsh, the independent counsel, met the committee's chairman, David Boren, and ranking minority member Frank Murkowski, and staff counsel in Boren's office. Reiterating what I had already told Boren, we said that two questions had not been answered satisfactorily. Had Gates falsely denied knowledge of Oliver North's Contra support activities? Had Gates falsely post-dated his first knowledge of North's diversion of arms sale proceeds to the Contras? Now, for those who've forgotten, Nicaragua was the victim of an internal civil war funded by the United States. Actually, sort of the Contras were a former
National Guardsmen under Somoza.
Correct.
Primarily.
Foreign army. They were a native army, but they were an army of an ideological sort.
Yeah, former, I meant to say. Former National Guardsmen.
And they received funding and logistics support through a kind of a combination of drugs for weapons deals that the Reagan administration did with Iran, of all people, over and it was sort of masterminded by people like Rumsfeld and Cheney, who
Amazing.
Were also Iran at that time. And, of course, Bill Gates here was being considered for head of the CIA. He had previously had a position, not quite sure what it was. I guess I read about it today in the paper as I read about his, you know, his new rise in the old administration with a new face or a couple of new people. Anyway, it was essentially an attempt to overthrow the Sandinistas, ultimately successful in the sense that the Sandinistas, the country was so torn apart by the Contra blockade by the U.S. and the Contra civil war that they held an election which they lost to...
They happily voted in the U.S.-backed candidate.
Right, who was, I guess, previously the head of La Prensa, the opposition newspaper.
But you know what? Happy
Chamorro
days. Happy days may be back again because Ortega's back in.
Well, Ortega has apparently, he's talking about the wonders of free enterprise, free trade, and
don't say.
Lovey-dovey activity with the U.S. I mean, I'm afraid the original Sandinista party that he was with has backed a different candidate. We won't get into his sexual
escapades.
He must
have seen the light.
What's that?
He must have seen the light.
He must have seen something. Anyway, this article about Gates and Iran-Contra, maybe it's a little obscure and a little dated. And perhaps it can be summed up in those questions, which Gates apparently did not answer. And, you know, it's like appointing Negroponte, the Guatemalan torture master, to, what was it? He was the U.S. ambassador to Iraq, or he, I believe that was his position. I guess it's
briefly.
Yeah,
briefly,
I mean,
within the last 2 years.
So I mean, you've got all these old war criminals coming back in high positions. I guess no surprise, considering this is a bigger war crime than ever, and you need your war criminals all together to do the right war crime activity. But I think it's worth noting as people celebrate. Let's see if there's anything else that I want to. Well, here's another cranky columnist, Joshua Frank, who I like to read from. The Democrats won, big deal, election hangover. Thank goodness it's finally over. Well, almost anyway. Recounts are still going on out in Montana, where John Tester holds a slight lead over incumbent Senator Conrad Burns. Of course, the Democrats have won. It's generally agreed they've won both the Senate and the House of Representatives. The Democrats swept the House last night, and now they are oh so close to controlling the United States Senate. I actually have, since this was written. And the message voters sent Bush is being heard loud and clear. The Republicans and this war are not popular in America. Pundits are claiming that it was the anti-war vote that helped usher the Dems back into power. It's just too bad that the Democrats aren't going to repay their constituents with anything worthwhile, for the war in Iraq will rage on. Third-party anti-war candidates didn't fare as well as they would have liked. Aaron Dixon, who ran as a Green in Washington State, garnered a little over 10,000 votes. Green Party candidate Howie Hawkins, who ran against Senator Hillary Clinton in New York, scored a little over 51,500 votes. Independent candidate Kevin Zeese of Maryland, who made his way into a series of debates in the state, cashed in over 23,700 votes, while Green Todd Chrétien of California topped 106,000 in his bid to take on Senator Dianne Feinstein. Overall, it could have been worse, as all aforementioned candidacies were virtually ignored by the mainstream anti-war movement. Whether or not you're feeling good about last night's results, this was written yesterday, you can rest assured that the empire is still intact. Impeachment of this outlaw administration isn't going to fall down within the next 2 years, or perhaps come down. Nancy Pelosi, the new House leader, has promised as much. Deaths in Iraq will continue to mount, and no exit strategy will play out in the coming months. Global warming will still not be addressed, nor will our position on Israel, the war on drugs, free trade, or privatized health care. Basically, things are still damn bleak despite the liberal takeover of Washington. As I sat at the bar last night watching the tallies roll in, cheers from across the room would interrupt my daydreaming. Another Democrat had won, I have to admit. I, too, felt good about the defeat of Rick Santorum and a few other filthy Republicans. It's nice to see a rabid homophobe go down in flames now and again. But it is just too bad that nothing substantial will come out of it. Bob Casey, Santorum's replacement, is pro-life and anti-gay himself, but the lesser evil one, so shut up and be happy about it. In New York, K Street watchdog Elliot Spitzer was victorious in his quest for the governorship, and like Barack Obama, Spitzer is seen as a beacon of hope within the Democratic establishment. But like Obama, Spitzer has his sour issues. Aside from supporting the death penalty and the war in Iraq, Spitzer was one of the chief architects of New York's own version of the Patriot Act. It was an exhibit of what's to come in 2008. Centrism in the Democratic Party is back. Not that it ever left, it's just in power again. The Democrats won last night, not because they offered voters any real choices. They won because people were fed up with the Republicans and their deceitful ways. Joshua Frank is the author of Left Out, How Liberals Helped Re-Elect George W. Bush, and he edits www.brickburner.org. If you have any comments on these tirades, you're welcome to call in. Phone number here is 831-427-3772. What about you, Condor? You have any comments on this?
Yes, I do.
What do you have to say?
First of all, I would like to know, or I'm curious as to what percentage of actually eligible voters actually did participate. It's probably still a minority of all those actually eligible to vote. So those that supposedly voted out the Republicans and voted in the Democratic Party are actually probably a very small portion of total eligible voters. Probably the majority stayed away. I notice they always seem to harp on the center, middle class, helping the middle class. I don't even know when talking about helping the poor, the disenfranchised, at least in terms of the stump speeches, victory speeches. That's what I noticed. I watched a lot of the various sources of information and media. I'd like to hear more about basic security, basic national security for all people, you know, in terms of providing decent housing, access to health care, excellent health care. You know, provide more national security than any $1 trillion bombs and missiles could do. As far as the war in Iraq, it seems to me that it might have to go the way of Vietnam, where it was the actual soldiers in the field revolting en masse that actually brought it to a halt, when it really came right down to it. That and a lot of disenfranchisement at home expressed through a lot of protests and activism. So it remains to be seen. All we got to do is watch now. Typically, when you're the leading party in power, then you get blame for everything that goes wrong. Well, look what happened to the Republican Party, if you can believe what the public results are. Eventually, you might have the power, but you also have to take the responsibility. when things go sour. And by the way, man, you're really sucking on that big, giant jug. Maybe you better not, because you talk too fast. You really get hyped up. Here, pass me some more of that juice, please.
All right. We're tanking ourselves up in the studio with the 7-Eleven Big Gulp, which I needn't even go into.
Robert's Special Blend.
Let's pour a little for you there.
Thanks.
Gregarious Greg.
All right.
Well, now we should turn to the local elections, since that's what we're stuck with here in Santa Cruz, the most abysmal city council probably in several decades. We have, of course, on the city council now, Rotkin, Matthews, Robinson, and, of course, the old stalwarts, Porter, Madrigal,
Riley,
Coonerty, and Riley. I actually prepared a flyer chronicling the virtues of Rotkin and Matthews for those who like kind of quasi-police state stuff at the micro level here in Santa Cruz, ranging from the parking garage paranoia law. Hang in there, Greg. The 15 minutes in a parking lot, actually a parking garage, or, well, you can't walk into a parking garage these days, even as the weather gets colder and wetter, unless you happen to have the presence of a bicycle or car. That is to say, unless you are the owner of a bicycle or car and it's with you and you're parking it, or else you're part of a group that is, let's say, going to the car and getting in it, and that's right. You can't go up to a friend and help them with their groceries. You can't sit in the car for more than 15 minutes, even if you're parking the car, read a book while waiting for who knows what. We went through all this, actually, about 6 months ago. And I think we were able to restrict this absurd law to the parking garages and, of course, the one homeless parking lot. Homeless not in the sense that it provides any kind of sanctuary for the homeless, but that it's nearest a regular homeless service, the Elm Street Mission parking lot number 9. That parking lot and the four parking garages have become no-go zones unless you are the owner of a bicycle or car and parking that car or bicycle. Because, you see, you are a suspect in an ongoing criminal investigation, and you can't be there. That's to protect our personnel from overnight campers and vandals and bicycle thieves and sex perverts. It depends on, you know, what page of the book you want to go to. The reality, of course, as I've said before in the past, is that the police stats just do not justify this kind of a measure. The tradition of the town does not justify it, and hopefully people will resist it when they begin to enforce it. The signs are up. I talked to parking czar Matt Farrell earlier. Actually, I saw him in a gas station. We waved at each other and said howdy. And he told me that he would be getting back to me. He hasn't yet, but his underling, the person who substituted for him and took his calls while he was away, told me that they still haven't yet gotten up the so-called free speech, what's the word? Is it a zone? Is it an exception? I don't know what it is. Unconstitutional lawyer Ryan Coonerty, he likes to think of himself as an expert in constitutional law, or at least a teacher of constitutional law, is nothing worse than someone like John Yoo, who teaches constitutional law. He's the guy at UC Berkeley who gave the Bush administration all its... You're not
my old alma mater.
He's not really torturing you. You're not really being tortured when you're having when they're threatening to shoot your children, or when they're putting your head under water, or when they're giving you electrical shock. That's not really torture, because it doesn't result in serious permanent loss of life or limb. You see, that's not really torture, and it's really a matter of definition.
No, they narrowed it very restrictively.
So I think in the Yoo tradition, constitutional or unconstitutional lawyer Ryan Coonerty is giving us his interpretation of the Bill of Rights, that you don't really lose any rights when you bar everybody from using public spaces except those who are paying for those spaces at the moment or have an immediate vehicle or bicycle there, because they can always take their free speech activities somewhere else. Well, the city council decided that they had to really slip in something about free speech, or it might be legally vulnerable, even though we have a conservative judiciary.
Then I guess I'll have to take advantage of it. Where is it?
Well,
I'll go grab my guitar and go stand in the free speech
actually,
zone.
CJ's stock is doing just that tonight. But as I said, I'm told that enforcement of this parking garage paranoia law, as I call it, will not start until late November.
We'll see what kind of anecdotal stories we start to hear as the weather turns more sour and rainy, and who's taking shelter in there.
Well, that brings me to my next subject, which has to do with a demonstration which apparently won't be rained out tomorrow in front of Lulu Carpenters.
Juju?
Lulu Carpenters, about issues of selective enforcement of the laws, abusive treatment of poor people on the streets, and actually also disabled people. A man named Shane Maxfield, who has AIDS and who was recently evicted from his apartment along with a tenants' rights activist, Donna Dice, now lives in a vehicle, was peacefully panhandling in a legal place, of which there are few, but there are some along Pacific Avenue, outside of Manfree Srinath's Lulu Carpenters. Manfree is the owner of Lulu Carpenters, I understand, as well as the owner of some coffee shop up in Scotts Valley and another one due to open somewhere else in the county.
Hmm.
And he's also rather notorious because, in my book, because he came out and threw hot coffee and in the direction of, on the sign of, and perhaps on the person of, a peace activist in 2003.
Probably was uptight that day because he hadn't had his coffee colonic.
I don't wish to disparage the owner of Lulu Carpenters on a personal basis. We all have our eruptions of emotion. We all have our bad days. The question is, what does one do afterward? Does one apologize and make up for it? Does one attempt to engage in restitution? Or does one ignore the issue and continue the kind of attitudes and policies that, to me, are part and parcel of the whole problem downtown, which are sort of symbolized by the downtown ordinances, the laws that set up forbidden zones for people. Even though they're doing absolutely nothing wrong, it's illegal to sit down within 14 feet of a building. It's illegal to sit down within 50 feet of a change-making machine.
Mm.
It's illegal to have a political table for more than an hour in any one spot downtown. A whole series of rules essentially give the police the power to respond to cranky merchants who have decided that they don't like people on the public thoroughfare in front of their shop, in spite of the fact that they don't seem to realize they don't own the public sidewalks. It's interesting. Even the community tends to have the misimpression that that merchants own the public sidewalks. I went to some folks who were tabling in front of the attic, right, as Simba Kenyatta was running for city council. They were Simba for council people. And I said, you realize what you're doing here is illegal. You can't be within 10 feet of a building with this table. That's an illegal positioning of a table. I don't really care. I'm glad you're here. Keep tabling. And they said, oh, no, we have the permission of the business to be here. In fact, of course, the permission of the business has nothing to do with whether you're following the law or violating the law. The same point I made and that James Ney, another activist, made to police officers in front of the ice cream shop downtown. What is it?
Well, there's Stone Cold.
Nope, it ain't that one. It starts with an M.
Marini's.
Marini's. I keep mistaking Marini's for the other ice cream shop across town that also starts with an M. But Marini's, they were the police officer Howes recently got a 25-year pin for noble service, and Rotkin did not allow any public comments about that it would have, tarnished this great officer's image. He was running a table that was within 10 feet of Marini's, and it wasn't on private property. It was on the public sidewalk.
It was a sweet occasion.
It was very sweet. And it wasn't that the police were doing anything wrong in terms of the substance of what they were doing, but they were doing what they had cited people for doing within a month or two previous, namely having a table in an illegal position.
Hey, I don't see no red lights blinking. What's the problem here?
Well, apparently people are so captivated with my rhetorical analysis here that they don't want to interrupt.
Is anybody out there?
With phone calls. So, but your point is well taken. Phone calls are, of course, always welcome.
Are you sure that thing's online?
Welcome. 427-3772 is the phone number to call in. You can chat or comment on anything I'm saying, or anything I'm not saying, for that matter, if it isn't too distant from the topic at hand. Unless you have some topic you think that we should be covering that sort of is covered in the general poverty and civil rights arena that we're discussing. Anyway, so Lulu Carpenters, tomorrow between 4 and 8, will be the scene of tabling. Yes, we'll be out there with surveying the community as to a couple of things. One, How do they feel about? I'm actually thinking of proposing a new law for city council that would do essentially what. I'm thinking of both a law that might be used by city council, might be passed by city council, or a voluntary code that the merchants might pass. Since the merchants have successfully defeated Measure G, the minimum wage ordinance.
How beneficent of them.
Yes, well, they did. They were able to do that through large expenditures of money and chatter and chit-chat, although most of the people I talked to, who are employees, of course, favored Measure G. I mean, naturally, I guess your pocketbook and the need to pay rent, which many merchants... It's hard to say. I've never seen a profit or loss statement for any of these merchants who are so adamant that their business is about to go under if they pay a minimum wage of $9.25 an hour to employees.
So that's probably a crock.
You know, I'm thinking that they should make their records public. I'm thinking that they should themselves adopt a voluntary policy. I talked to one merchant today who suggested that even on a bad day, considering the tips, people in restaurants who work there get at least $15 an hour, which I found a remarkable statement, but I don't know. So we're going to be doing a little research to find out how much do people actually make downtown, suggesting people come over and discuss that with us. We're also going to have a petition. This is the typical Huff style, Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom, the group I work with. We kind of cover a variety of issues. There have, of course, been decisions, as listeners to this show know, regarding the sleeping ban in San Diego and Los Angeles. San Diego and Los Angeles have agreed, at least for the time being, until the Ninth Circuit Court decision in the Jones case is overturned, which hasn't happened, and actually that whole legal process is frozen right now as the L.A. authorities try to work out a settlement with the people who did the lawsuit. But right now it is... The police are barred in Los Angeles from arresting any homeless person in the Skid Row area at night, or between, I guess, 9 or 9.30 and 6 or 6.30 in the morning. And San Diego's city attorney has adopted a similar policy in an attempt to avoid a lawsuit. So the obvious question here in Santa Cruz is, we have a law that criminalizes people at night from 11 to 8.30 in the morning. It also criminalizes covering up with a blanket. It criminalizes having a tent at any time, even if it's raining like hell and you've got nowhere else to go. It's illegal to put up a tent. That's camping paraphernalia, you see. So we're going to be circulating a petition that demands, or maybe politely requests, I'm not quite sure how it's going to be worded, the city attorney perhaps asks the city manager to direct the city attorney, or asks the city council to pass a resolution asking the city manager to direct the city attorney to do what L.A. and do what San Diego have done, which is say we're not going to arrest you at night.
It seems to me that there's a momentum that's been building up on the state and national level where it'll come to a head here. Seems inevitable.
Well, I hope you're right. I'm concerned that...
They cannot ignore it.
Well,
forever. They can pretend for a while, but eventually it's going to be right in their face.
Well, they've successfully ignored it for decades.
Naturally. Because the heat wasn't that great.
Well, the heat is unfortunately not very great now.
The heat is on!
Homeless people, as you may know, Greg, are not terribly interested in challenging this law and getting their butts thrown in jail, usually.
Naturally, who is?
Or ticketed. They don't particularly want to stand together, and people in houses are also reluctant to join into this
struggle. Isn't that amazing how cozy everybody is?
So I don't know why you would say that things are necessarily about to change. I wouldn't agree
with
you.
The legal aspects of it.
Well, the legal aspects are actually rather uncertain, because I talked today to National Lawyers Guild President Carol Sobel, who hopefully will be on the air.
Ah, real subversive organization.
Maybe in a week. They're actually, they're at least two decades ahead of the American Civil Liberties Union, which is...
Indeed.
Fighting the good fight for, I don't know, Nazis and gay rights, and I don't know. I mean, I'm dismissing that, but there, ACLU did put in a little energy, mainly because of the work of Don Zimmerman here, who still is a little too, considerably too timid for my taste.
But Don Corleone.
Not Don Zimmerman, actually, is his name.
I know.
He helped to fight the 15-minute parking garage paranoia law, and helped the ACLU pressure helped to exclude it from the parking lots generally. And they also, I think they registered some concerns, not that it made a dime's worth of difference, about the police department's political surveillance policies locally, which I also hope to have an interview with Mark Schlossberg on. I spoke to him this week. He may be calling in because even though our recrowned shadow mayor, Mike Rotkin, promised as head of the Public Safety Committee that he directed Dick Wilson, the city attorney, or city manager for life, Dick Wilson, to
Dick?
Get back to the ACLU and say why have they rejected the ACLU's guidelines and allowed the police chief to essentially implement his own unilateral, relatively meaningless guidelines. Mark Schlossberg thinks that it's better than nothing. I don't. But, you know, we can agree to disagree on that. So we should be having some more information on that in a future show. But the issue is going to come up again because there's organizing going on where there's going to be another first night activity, or last night, if you will. And, you know, who knows? I mean, are we going to have another Halloween police scene downtown with many an armed officer in a squad of 8 to 10 goose-stepping around town? You know, I don't know. I mean, I was kind of... I not only didn't like the sight of these officers, I didn't like the way they acted. And I know that mine may not be the common view. I saw them, I only saw them in one arrest situation. And the way they did there, they were attempting to intimidate people who were trying to observe and record what they were doing. And they wouldn't allow the public to listen on what was happening, which is a violation of the civil rights of the public. And also violates the civil rights of the person being arrested, because the person being arrested has a lot better chance of being treated well if what he's doing is being observed by others instead of the public being pushed back and their arresting officers being insulated by a kind of a, I wouldn't say a wall of police, but several police officers who were staring down and advancing on people.
At least a wall of voodoo.
Who were trying to... observe.
I'm aware of it. I've experienced it many times.
Indeed. And I observed it on Halloween. I think we're going to see it again.
And nobody got shot.
Two people got stabbed, and a lot of people may have gotten falsely arrested for such things as public intoxication, yeah. Probably warrants, maybe bad attitude. I don't know.
I actually saw parole officers downtown. I thought it was a costume at first.
This was on Halloween?
Yeah. It was amazing. Turns out they were looking for parolees that they recognized and see if they were in violation of the parole, so they can nab them out on the app.
You know, what is this shit? You know, on Halloween, people are supposed to be able to come out and enjoy themselves. Is this an opportunity for the police to nitpick and jail people on what were probably abusive abusive charges in the first place, many of which are related to the drug war? We're going to be talking about the drug war later this evening with Ben Rice. Again, he'll be calling in hopefully at 7:30.
That's if your phone's online.
I hope my phone's online. I encourage someone to give a call just as a test to see if... in fact, I may do that right now just to see if everything is on the up and up.
See if it's plugged in.
And see if we actually have a phone line. I sort of assume we do, but I perhaps shouldn't assume. Let's see if we can get Kate Wells here.
When are you going to roll some bumper music?
I don't know. We're trying a phone call right now, Condor. Let's see. And I hear a phone ringing, so that certainly means something.
Hello?
Kate Wells.
Hey.
I'm at the Free Radio Santa Cruz studio calling in. I wanted to get your reaction to the election results.
Maybe. some good, some bad.
How about locally? Are you pleased as punch that Mike Rotkin, Cynthia Matthews?
Oh, God.
Now, come on. Don't you want to give them another chance?
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, I guess I wasn't too disappointed because I expected it. So I didn't expect anything different.
What about the defeat of Measure G downtown, the rent, the minimum wage?
Minimum wage, yeah. That's a pity. I think... you know, there are a few issues in the ballot that show, you know, where Santa Cruz really is on the progressive scale, and obviously they proved themselves to be pretty low.
What about this Measure K, the lowest enforcement for marijuana, and the setting up of a kind of a documentation where Santa Cruz police are giving out medical marijuana or marijuana tickets for, you know, for adults in public, or I should say in private, because that is supposed to be allowed to
Right.
To smoke in private. What do you think this is going to have any significant impact? I don't know. What's your feeling about this?
Well, you know, we've all heard Marasoni hemming and hawing about the whole thing and saying that it's unworkable and that chief of police is saying it's unworkable. We'll have to see what's going to happen. You know, again, you know, marijuana is always the kind of the poster child issue for how progressive the city council thinks they are. So, I don't know. It'll be interesting to see what really comes from it. You know, I think their protests are ridiculous. Obviously, it's not that difficult to put it on the lowest priority. You know.
Yeah, I spoke with Carol Sobel earlier this evening. She's the president of the National Lawyers Guild down in Los Angeles.
Uh-huh.
She has taken a number of lawsuits on, including she prepared the Jones decision lawsuit in L.A.
Oh, good.
She also is working in Venice trying to fight the police action against street performers and street merchants down there, vendors.
Mm-hmm.
And she's concerned that, as you probably are too, with the fact that the conservative quality of the courts makes it less and less likely that unconstitutional laws like Santa Cruz's move every hour law will be overturned or found unconstitutional or found defective.
Right. It is increasingly more difficult. They are, the courts are leaning over backwards to find some connection between health and safety or legitimate reasons for controlling time, place, and manner of exercise of First Amendment rights that the courts, you know, it's been this way for a long time. You know, I mean, I know it because I, you know, that's all I do is fight the government. And
you're primarily a person who does a lot of federal lawsuits around police misconduct, right?
Yeah, police misconduct. You know, I've had a good amount of First Amendment cases as well. But, first, fourth, fifth, eighth amendment cases.
I know that before, within the last couple of years, you've been particularly concerned about the rollback of rights and such matters as infraction detention stops and a person who, let's say, is sleeping at night and the mm-hmm. police officer comes upon that person, they can now jail that person even though the offense is an infraction, not one that you're supposed to be able to jail someone for, isn't
it? Well, what they can do is take you into full custodial arrest. You know, whether or not they jail the person, it doesn't really matter because it's an excuse for them to be able to search someone that they are suspicious maybe carrying some sort of contraband, but can't get it in any other legal way. They can, you know, grab you for an infraction and then place you under custodial arrest. The case that came down in the California Supreme Court was a guy who was riding his bicycle the wrong way down a one-way street, and they took him into full custodial arrest, searched him, found some marijuana. He claimed that it was a false arrest, that they couldn't arrest him because it was an infraction, and the California Supreme Court used a U.S. Supreme Court case out of Texas to say that they can put you in full custodial arrest for even the most minor offense, which, you know, obviously, you know, jaywalking, whatever. So it's kind
why, of... Why, because of officer safety or because of what? What was their reasoning?
Their reasoning was that this was what the U.S. Supreme Court had said.
What was the U.S. Supreme Court's reasoning?
All right. The U.S. Supreme Court, their reasoning was, well, see, that was a Texas case. It was a Texas seatbelt case.
The soccer mom and the seatbelt.
Right, right, where they put her in full custodial arrest for violation of seatbelt law.
But that was technically a misdemeanor in Texas.
In Texas, it was a misdemeanor,
right.
And that's the argument that has been made, that I have made several times, that case should be distinguished. However, when the California Supreme Court had the opportunity to distinguish that case, they didn't. And, in fact, they
what was the name of that ruling, Kate, in the year? Do you remember?
Which one?
The one where they took away our right to be free from arrest for an infraction.
You talking about the U.S. Supreme Court?
No,
case?
The California
Supreme Court case.
Right.
Oh, my God. You know, I sent it to you. I don't know.
You recall the name of the case?
It's in the last 2 or 3 years. Jeez, you're making me. I usually have it.
Yeah, we can. You know, you, maybe at some point you can look it up and let us know, and I'll pass it on.
I usually have it on the tip of my tongue, but for some reason I can't bring it up right now.
There were on the ballot. Did you vote in the last election?
Yeah, sure.
You noticed there were Judge McAdams, a number of other judges were running for confirmation. I voted no on all the judges.
Yeah.
What do you think? Is that a negative approach?
Well, I think that. You know, if you don't know, that you shouldn't vote, or you should vote no. You know, certainly there are some that I knew and was willing to vote yes on. The others I just left blank.
Now, did all the judges get confirmed regardless of our vote?
I'm pretty sure they did. Yeah. I don't know whether it's just a natural human response to want to confirm them or what, but it's overwhelming how many, you know, unless they've, you know, raped a child or, you know, done something really outrageous.
Later on this show, Ben Rice is going to be coming on talking about medical marijuana in mm-hmm. Santa Cruz County.
Mm-hmm.
Many people are kind of under the misimpression that it's the evil feds who are doing most of the arresting and harassment in Santa Cruz, when in fact it's actually the sheriff's department and the local courts and DA Bob Lee.
Right. Right.
So I'm wondering, what do you see as the remedy for the kinds of problems that Roger Minch, the Emporium owner, the Felton Marijuana Distribution Center, that he has twice been arrested for this, once that's gone through a lengthy series of trials. He mm-hmm. faces again a hearing, I think, on November 15th.
Mm-hmm.
What should voters,
well, you know,
citizens,
one of our problems that has been for a long time are federal grants and federal and state grants that our local law enforcement take. Let's put it this way, they have trouble just saying no to all this money.
Right.
And so, you know, tied along with those grants are certain things that they have to do that aren't necessarily what the local population wants them to do. But they get hooked on the money and, you know, it's camp, it's all those federal funds that are tied to marijuana eradication. So that's part of the problem. And, you know, the other part of the problem is that we just, we have a lot of people who don't realize that Article 3, Section 3.5 of the California Constitution says that they have to uphold our marijuana law, regardless of whether or not the federal law contravenes the law.
But I think that it's not the federal law that is the concern of, or the pretext that the sheriffs and DAs use locally to go after people like Minch.
Mm-hmm.
If you look at the text of the preliminary hearings that Minch went through, the DAs here are claiming that even clubs like Greenway are illegal unless that you can show a close connection between the marijuana distributor and the person receiving the marijuana as a caregiver.
Well, that's the problem. See, the only case that really came down out of the U.S. Supreme Court is the Oakland Cannabis Buyers Club, and they, of course, ruled against them. That they could not be a caregiver. That's the major problem. That is a case that does have an effect on California law. You know, we can't just ignore that case. And so technically, yeah, it's true.
Well, why is it that our city council, which likes to give away medical marijuana free to a few favored WHAM people on the steps of City
mm-hmm.
Hall, as it did in 2002,
mm-hmm.
and at the same time likes to hold in place for 5 years laws that essentially exclude clubs like the one you attempted to open
mm-hmm.
in 2000,
mm-hmm.
Why don't they speak out about this issue in terms of putting some pressure on the county to stop this kind of abusive behavior towards people who are essentially dealing with medical problems. They aren't even talking about recreational marijuana.
The other problem is that the one case that has reached the appellate level courts in the state of California is, and I'm having trouble placing the name of the case right now, but it quite clearly ruled that the law, Prop 215, the law is a shield and not a sword, which means that you can't use the law to keep them from arresting you. What you can do is use it as a defense after they've arrested you. I think it may be the Trippett case, but I'm... No,
but isn't this the same county that says, that's issuing medical marijuana cards? I mean, I got one the other day. You know?
I know. It's...
What's going on here? How can we allow people like Bob Lee, with his genial smile and his easy manner and his liberal patina, to act as though, you know, essentially to engage in the kind of repressive expeditions that we associate more with people like Anslinger and, you know, drug warriors of the past?
You got me. I guess I would give you the answer that a lot of cops say when you ask them why they do what they do, because they can.
That's what Lieutenant Clark said when he took away the blankets from the homeless.
Exactly.
Because
exactly.
I can.
Exactly.
He's a powerful man, that Lieutenant Clark.
Oh, boy, yeah.
Any cases coming up, Kate, that we should know about, that you are, any cases coming up in court that people should be following that you're involved with? I know I have my case coming up in March of 2007, holding the city council to account for a pattern of repression there.
Mm-hmm.
But that's a ways down the road. Anything else happening that you think people should know about?
I have, my usual litany of police misconduct cases I'm going to be probably filing suit against the city of Watsonville sometime soon to overturn their anti-tattoo law, which, a client who wants to open a tattoo shop, and we found out that Watsonville actually has a law preventing a tattoo shop.
What about the helmet case,
First
Richard?
Amendment issue. We got actually two fronts of working on that. We got it, we have a case in Nevada to overturn the Nevada helmet law, which is just like the California helmet law. And then we also have an action that we hope to have filed by this week, but it's probably going to be filed next week for injunctive and declaratory relief in the Superior Court here in Santa Cruz to get the judge to sign an injunction against enforcement of the law.
What's the current status of the helmet law? I mean, can you wear a baseball cap and say it's a helmet and not get bothered by the California Highway Patrol or the Watsonville Police?
I guess I'd have to say right now it depends on who you are.
Really?
If you're Richard Quigley, sure, go for it.
We can all have Richard Quigley masks, perhaps?
Yeah, exactly. But they're still trying to enforce the stupid law, even though it's so clearly unconstitutional. It's unbelievable. The other thing that I think is really was a frightening law that they had on the books and that they had in this last election was the sex offender law,
which has been put on hold.
Yeah, thank God. Judge Ilston, who I have actually had a case go to trial in front of Judge Ilston up in San Francisco. She's an excellent judge, and she saw through this thing. Evidently, the plan was to, because they can't be within a certain distance of a park.
2,000 feet.
Yeah, they were going to declare every little area a park that they possibly could, so that, there would be no place where they could live. They also extended the definition of sex offender to include anyone who'd basically kind of been, accused of it by an angry ex or soon-to-be ex-wife, all of those sorts of things. They expanded the whole definition of a sex offender. so that it would include a whole lot of people that, you know, most likely had never been guilty of anything.
And now you have a taser case coming up too, right?
Yeah, I've got a taser case that we're actually in settlement negotiations right now, but, you know, of a kid who was tased several times after he had already been apprehended. They tased him 3 or 4 times.
Well, he just wanted to make sure he understood the seriousness of the situation.
Yeah. Happy birthday. It was his 24th, 25th birthday.
A birthday he'll never forget.
Yeah, a birthday he'll never forget. Yeah.
Finally, I wanted to tell you that I spoke with Carol Sobel, a National Lawyers Guild. Maybe I mentioned this to you earlier. And she was talking about the Jones decision in Los Angeles, about the fact that the city attorneys of Los Angeles and San Diego have both, in essence, said, you know, don't arrest homeless people at night at least in L.A. in the Skid Row area, in San Diego, I think it may even be citywide, because we're vulnerable to lawsuits around that issue, given the Federal Court of Appeals decision, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. And it's true, she says also, though, that in Los Angeles, police have been sent in during the day in massive numbers to harass and disperse the homeless because they can't do it at night. So in essence, they're trying to say, yeah, you can stay at night, but we'll beat the bushes for you during the day. And people are, of course, leaving the area for that reason. That's the objective.
Yeah.
This is still on its face. Isn't this a kind of a decision that can be used to challenge? Can we not challenge our city attorney, John Barisoni, to say, why can't you at least do what Los Angeles and San Diego do, which is to say, because we have shelter tonight for less than 45 people, and even when the armory goes into high gear later this month, maybe 150 or 160 people out of 1,500 to 2,000 people, why can't we have that same ruling, at least protect the citizenry, if not the homeless?
Well, our law is exactly the polar opposite from L.A.'s law, and that's the bizarre part about it. L.A.'s law outlaws sleeping during the day.
Well, L.A. law, it outlaws day and night. It outlaws sleeping, sitting, or lying any time of the day or night throughout the city.
That's right, yeah.
But the point is, it's in the San Diego practice, we've got to go to San Diego, too, to look at what they're doing, although Carol Sobel says you have a compassionate city attorney there. I think that's kind of a contradiction in terms, talk about a compassionate city attorney in a big city, but maybe that happens. In San Diego, you have a situation where it's the police practice of harassing and ticketing and citing poor people, homeless people, without an alternative, with no shelter bed, that is being challenged. And that is something they've agreed to because they're afraid of the decision. They distinguish their law from Los Angeles's, too, I imagine, but they still are afraid that they will be held legally liable. Isn't that apprehension something we can use to try to, you know, get Barisoni online?
Absolutely. Absolutely, I think so. I think so. I think it's time to do it. I think it's time to do it.
Okay. Well, I know that we didn't prepare this call. We ambushed you, Kate.
That's okay.
And I appreciate your coming.
I'm used to it.
Go ahead. You're used to it. Yeah.
I'm used to it.
Anything you want to add about any other thoughts about ongoing either legal or political issues around the police or abuse of power? I know you were quite dismayed when Donald Rumsfeld was replaced by Iran-Contragate hero Bill Gates.
Kind of like...
Or Robert Gates, actually.
Yeah, unbelievable. We'll see what happens, you know. Isn't Bob Gates the one who made the case for torture?
I don't know about that. I know that he was accused by Walsh, the independent counsel. I was just reading an article on Counterpunch of being responsible for a significant part of the Iran-Contra drugs for weapons cover-up in the 80s under the Reagan regime.
Right, yeah. Oh, man. Bunch of crooks.
I am not a crook.
All right, have a nice evening.
Hey, thank you, Kate.
Bye.
That was Attorney Kate Wells. Now is your chance to call in, and we will afford you the same status as Attorney Kate Wells. You'll be able to chat, too. And if you can answer questions with as much information as she does, you may actually be able to stay on the phone a longer period of time before Greg here gives you the hook. I take all my cues from Gregarious Greg, who's my co-host here in the studio.
You're tuned to Free Radio, 101.1 FM, freakradio.org. I'm Robert Norris, and the phone line is 427-3772. Lest I be accused of chattering too much, here's a little interview with a man from the streets.
It's about 9 o'clock on Friday evening, October 27th, and I'm talking with Nicholas Peranda. And Nicholas, you just got an interesting letter in the mail from the city where they're trying to bill you $300.
Yeah, it's about $300.
And how did this all begin? Where does this all stem from?
This happened about 5 years ago.
Okay, what happened 5 years ago?
I was in a building in a house, and I was laying down, and the cops came into the house. The door was wide open. It sounded like they didn't want to lock the door because they knew people were going to go in.
They being the police? Or?
Yes.
And where was this house?
It was off of Ocean Street, by the ocean.
Now, is this sort of a crash bed? You were looking for a place to sleep? Or?
Yes.
And were you the only one involved, or were other people involved?
Yes, I was the only one involved.
And had you been sleeping there before?
No.
So this was the first night you slept there, and this was like late in the evening when this happened?
Well, I think I only stayed there for about 3 or 4 nights, but that was the only time I stayed in the building.
And about what time of night did this police incident occur?
I would say more like around 11:30.
And describe for me what happened.
Cops came in. They drew their flashlights on me.
How many police?
2 officers. Both officers pulled out their 9mm and pointed their guns right at me.
Did they say anything?
No.
Okay, and what did you do?
I got up and I followed them outside.
Did they ask you to go outside?
Yes, they did.
And were you sleeping when this happened, or had you been awake? What was it?
I was awake and trying to stay warm.
We're talking winter, summer, fall?
I think that happened probably either spring or winter. I'm not 100% sure on that.
Okay, and then what happened? You went outside?
Right before I went outside, the police officer asked me if I smashed all the back windows.
So perhaps that's what drew the police attention to the building? Or?
No, I think he made that story up because the window was covered with plywood.
I see. So you know this because that's how it appeared when you had entered the building, or you came back later to check?
When I entered the front door was wide open. And then I just laid down and I went to sleep.
Gotcha. The police took you outside, and what happened then?
The police officer...
He asked you about the windows.
He asked me about the windows. And I said, no, I didn't break them windows. How could I break them windows when there was plywood on the windows? So he actually made up a story.
What did he say?
Trying to accuse me of breaking the windows.
What did he say then?
He had nothing to say.
And so you say that later he made up a story, or you heard him say a story then?
Well, he asked me if I broke the windows, and I said no. I said, well, how could I break the window when there was plywood on the window?
And his comment was?
He looked at me different.
Okay, what about his partner?
His partner looked at me really different.
So,
evil. I would probably say they both looked at me evil. They were evil, looked like, well, why are you sleeping in a little tiny abandoned house?
Okay, now, what happened then?
Then the police officer wrote me a ticket.
What was the charge?
I think the charge was illegal lodging was the charge. Mm-hmm. Then the police officer said, you better not come down to the ocean because I'll meet up with you. Basically, he was threatening me for me not to come on that side of town.
And did you then disappear from that side of town, or what did you do?
I disappeared out of Santa Cruz.
So how long were you gone for?
I would say about 5 years.
And so you just came back recently?
Yes, I did.
So in other words, there's a warrant out for your arrest, and I can turn you in for a reward.
Right.
All right. Well, so you are a fugitive?
Yes.
And how have you been sleeping these nights? Are you outside? Are you inside?
I'm outside, staying with my friend because I feel that they want to gun me down like Happy John.
Now, why do you... I can understand maybe they're wanting to give you a failure to appear citation. Let's go around. But why do you say that you think they want to gun you down? I mean, have you been threatened since then?
No, I haven't. But one cop looked very, very evil at me on Pacific Street at their Metro police station.
This is recently, huh?
Yes.
But it wasn't one of the same cops from 5 years ago?
No.
Looks like you may be jumping to a conclusion. This officer may have known nothing about what happened to you 5 years ago.
That is correct.
So, what did this letter say that you got from the police department, and how did they send you a letter? How did you happen to receive it? Are you at the same address as 5 years ago?
No, I did not. Yes, I did have the same address 5 years ago. But the catch-22 on that is, how did they find out that I had the same address?
Well, maybe they just had that address in the computer and they just used it.
Okay, they probably had that address in the computer.
What did they send you, though?
They sent me a letter telling me that they're going to garnish funds from me if I don't pay the $274 fine.
Now, were you actually tried, or did you just never appear in court?
I never tried to go to court because I feel that it's going to bring more static on me, because the police down in San Francisco stole 380 pages of my whole file on my whole background that I've been saving for the past 3 years. And I felt that they would try to pull another number like that on me again.
Although this Santa Cruz Police Department is, of course, a different police department than the San Francisco Police Department.
Right. But Santa Cruz could try to pull...
Do something similar?
Right. They could do something similar.
So, without going into what that big file was, so you got this letter demanding $300-odd in a fine. You know, I don't know. You got the letter on you?
Yes, I do. Got the letter on
you. May I take a look at it?
Yes, you may.
I mean, there's a letter from Alliance One in San Diego, which says that you have a... We have found very few people deliberately try to avoid paying their obligations. Looking forward to your reply. If we don't hear from 10 days, we will take whatever steps necessary. And it gives your account representative is so-and-so, and you owe $517. But it doesn't say this is from any particular ticket. It just says it's an account due. And on the other side, here we are. Creditor is County of Santa Cruz, one for $272, and the other for $245, for a total of $517. And these are two citations. Did you get a second ticket?
Yes, I got a second ticket for an open container.
Which ultimately became a cost of $570, which they're sending out for payment through the San Diego debt collector. I would ignore it.
Ignore it, right?
Well, I mean, it depends. You could be arrested again on a failure to appear, of course, particularly after this is played on the air. But you don't... First of all, it's 5 years old.
Right.
And second of all, you know, it's a bogus ticket in the sense that it's a class crime you're being charged with.
Right.
Open container, you know, people who are the money to sit outside in a cafe and drink don't get charged these tickets.
Right.
You were homeless. I don't know, were you drunk and violent for any of these tickets?
No, I haven't. I was really nice to the police officer. The cops did try to get aggressive and try to scare me. And
both tickets, as well, the open container as well? Or just the first
ticket? I'm not 100% sure on both tickets, right. But the cop tried to scare me.
Well, he told you they want you to, you know, not be in his district, or he'd see you again down by the ocean. Didn't want to see you. He did scare you out of town on the ticket with the sleeping in the house, right?
That is correct.
Now, is this an illegal lodging misdemeanor? We call a 647J. Do you remember, or was it a sleeping van ticket? A municipal code 6.36010. You might not remember, but if you do, do you remember whether it was did it start with a 6 or did it start with a 9? Do you remember? Didn't expect you to after 5 years.
I'm not 100% sure.
The reason I ask is that 647J is a...
It was very dark that night.
Gotcha. I understand. No, there's no problem. And who would remember it 5 years later anyway? It sounds like a misdemeanor ticket, though. Sleeping tickets are usually somewhat cheaper, although failure to appear fines can be added. And also, you haven't been tried for this offense. So if they do arrest you...
I'm going to plead not guilty on both charges.
Okay, what they'll probably do is they'll try and hold you in jail. Try to make a call to the Huff line, 423-HUFF, although we don't have a collect phone line usually, but, you know, you might catch me. If it's a misdemeanor, you'll get a public defender. If it's an infraction, you'll get bailed out. You'll probably be offered time served, but I would encourage you to go to court and try it. Because you'll win necessarily, but because I think it's important to stand up for these issues, particularly if it's not me that has to take the rap.
Right. Well, I strongly feel that they're going to use these tickets against me in the future if they don't get their way.
Well, if there's, if you want to find out if there's a failure to appear out for you, you can go down to the courthouse and go up to the window in the basement on Department 10, in the very basement next to Department 10, and give them your name and say, are there any warrants out for me or any citations? At that window, unless we're talking murder or rape, they're not going to be calling the police on you, but they'll just tell you,
right.
And then you'll have the option. They'll tell you, and you ask, is it a bailable warrant? Do I have to go to the sheriff's office or the jail to deal with it?
Right.
And then you have the option to turn yourself in or to ignore it and to proceed about your life as you wish.
Well, I'm going to ignore it. The fact that the cops did pull their guns out on me, there was no reason for them to pull their guns out on me because they had their flashlights out on me at 11 o'clock at night. And I strongly believe the fact that the cop told me not to come back
as a threat
to the ocean was a very, very threat, like Happy John getting killed.
Okay, we've been talking with
Nicholas Ferrander.
Thanks, Nicholas.
And that was Nicholas F. And in the studio is, of course, the Condor, who's been listening to this. What have you heard about police treating people, threatening people downtown? I haven't heard a lot about this, although apparently this case we're going to be protesting tomorrow in front of Lulu Carpenter's from 4 to 8. Lulu Carpenter's, for those who don't know, is a place on Pacific Avenue right near where the... where North Pacific, Mission, Water Street, Front Street, and Pacific all kind of joined together right down there near the town clock. It's the very beginning of the mall. Lulu Carpenter's is a coffee shop, which I actually used to hold meetings in occasionally, patronize. I never had any problems in this coffee shop. I was a little concerned. I think they had somewhat... restrictive policies about posting flyers, but, you know, that's how as may be. But after this incident in 2003 when Manafri Srinath, the owner, on two separate occasions, separated by about 3 hours, threw coffee on three different activists.
Did they beat his ass?
I don't think so. Two of them were women. One of them was a young man who was protesting the earlier incident with a sign across the street, and Srinath was so outraged or incensed that he went across the street and threw coffee on the man, or at least in the direction of the man, or on his sign. It's not quite clear, you know. He was given a battery ticket, as I understand it, but the DA never pursued it, and it wasn't even a charge was never filed by the DA. Which brings up a whole issue which I want to bring up with Kate Wells, and hopefully is one of the recourses that...
We want to live in peace, Robert.
That homeless people, in peace rather than in pieces, as we say...
Generally speaking.
In Iraq.
It's important.
Anyway, tomorrow at Lula Carpenter's 4 to 8, I invite people to come on down. Help with the petitioning to encourage the city to at least adopt the compassionate policy that... economically sensible policy in terms of protecting the whole city from lawsuits, which is being done in San Diego and Los Angeles. That is, if Santa Cruz's homeless people have no legal place to sleep, you've got to let them sleep somewhere. It doesn't really mean anywhere and everywhere. It obviously means the city will have to designate certain areas where people can go.
Yep.
And set up porta potties and do some reasonable accommodations, which they...
Yeah, I'd like to do some good camping.
Rigidly refuse...
Set up my nice tent. I want
to do it right. For the last... two or three decades. Comments, Condor?
Well, I haven't heard of anybody being roughed up by the police lately, except the UCSC students up there at the Regents protest. They hear they got batoned and pepper sprayed, which was probably unwarranted, to be honest with you. But I personally haven't observed it, have not been subject to it. If it did happen to me,
well, we know
there would be accounting.
I know I've gotten this account of... the same man who was abusively treated by Amanda Freestreenith, which is why we're outside Lula Carpenter's. It's not that, I want to pursue a three-year-old vendetta with Streenith. I actually talked to Streenith about two weeks ago at a city council meeting. And, I told him, look, let's talk about this, get in touch. If you want to give your point of view, we can talk about it on the air. He's refused or declined to do that. And I talked about his behavior at the city council when I spoke at oral communications before the city council and the community. And again, his behavior was to come out and confront an AIDS-disabled man, Shane Maxfield, and demand he leave where he was sitting in a public space on the sidewalk with a sign and had a little bunny with him.
His problem?
Little rabbit. Well, I'm not quite sure, but my understanding from Shane and secondhand testimony from an employee who observed this was that he was very upset that there was a panhandler near his restaurant, as though, in fact, he had the right to set up some sort of cordon sanitaire, some sort of sanitary zone around his place. Now, in fact, the city council has, I feel unconstitutionally, given merchants the privilege to prohibit you from sitting within 10 feet of their outdoor seating area. So Shane made clear, he talked to police officers beforehand, he determined where he could sit legally, which is you have to be 14 feet away from a building, and because of your panhandling, it's 10 feet away from a building if you're just sitting. Actually, no, it's 14 feet if you're panhandling and 14 feet if you're sitting. It's 10 feet if you're at a political table. And so he was in a legal spot, but Srinath didn't like him there. I went up and started abusing him, denouncing him, telling him to get out of there. He wasn't welcome there. And Shane felt threatened, so he picked up he had a cell phone. He made a phone call to the police. Requested the police come down, 911. A cop came down, refused to take his charge. I was being threatened. And the cop said, unless they're threatening your life, I can't do anything about it. And so he essentially ignored the powerless, disabled, homeless man on the sidewalk. And then he told Serena that Shane had a right to be there. He had a right to sit there. Then he turned to Shane and said, you better move along or, and this is a quote from Shane, I smell a ticket coming. And Shane, I think, was trying to leave. He was waiting for his caretaker to...
He said, fine, give me the ticket.
Right. Well, who wants a ticket? It's in the courts, it usually means you have to deal with either a fine or community service, go to court. Here's a guy. Shane walks every day. From 6 a.m. in the morning down to Emmeline Street, from where he lives in a vehicle illegally. He has to sleep illegally in Santa Cruz. There's no housing for him. He walks all the way down to Emmeline. He gets his medication. He walks back. And so I don't think he can afford to spend his time walking to court either. But he has determined that he wants to press this matter legally. And indeed, that may be coming up. But in terms of tomorrow, what we're going to be doing tomorrow is we're going to be trying to encourage the community to make a statement to not just Manna Free Srina, because, well, what happened, let me conclude what happened. The officer then wrote Shane a ticket, What was Shane's crime? Well, in the course of the abusive language that he was getting, the abusive treatment he was getting from the owner of Lulu Carpenters, this is according to his account, Shane finally said, "You fucker," to him. That was used by the officer to claim that Shane had committed the crime of abusive language while panhandling, which is, of course, nonsense, because the abusive language refers, that ordinance was actually changed recently because the police were using it to go after John Maurer, you may remember, for having a fuck the pig sign in his hat after he'd been repeatedly harassed by the police. They said, oh, that's abusive language while panhandling. Of course, what's meant by the code section is if somebody turns you down, you say, you asshole, you fucker, you didn't give me any money. It doesn't refer to someone who comes up to you and starts abusing you, and you have to say, you fucker, back off. You have a perfect right to say that. And, of course, that was a false ticket. The ticket has never appeared in court. In essence, it sort of has disappeared. But that doesn't. But the point was, why would the police officer do this in the first place? And my concern is that this is the kind of thing that merchants and police seem to be doing. Whether it's musicians who are being told that their music is, they have to move along because a merchant doesn't like their music. Well, you know, the only legal basis for telling someone to move along in Santa Cruz if a merchant doesn't like your music is if it's unreasonable noise. And up until 10 o'clock, that's a pretty high standard. You can make a certain amount of noise even if the merchant doesn't like it. Now, the merchants have put in all these other laws. You have to move along every hour, that sort of thing. And that's a law that I've challenged myself. It hasn't gone higher in the courts. It was tried against activist Steve Argue, and that was thrown out. That is to say, the court dismissed the ticket based upon a technicality, and Kate Wells, who was interested in that case, did not take it into the higher courts because she was afraid, as you may remember, that the courts have a conservative cast, and they may well come down with a bad decision. So she was afraid that might happen. But it seems pretty clear to me that to make it illegal to set up a table, let's say a boycott table, in front of a place, and you can only be there for 1 hour, means a severe limitation on freedom of speech. I mean, the idea that you can only have a table for 1 hour there is, unless there's some other person demanding the space for some reason, or unless there's some legitimate public health or safety issue, it's simply an attempt to give merchants and police the power to move along people they want to move along. Because we all know on Pacific Avenue, we've seen Democratic Party people registering people to vote, sitting there hour after hour at their tables, not being bothered by the police. You even see some people like the Swami, who sits in front of or near the coffee roasting company downtown.
On the Dharma blanket,
hour after hour. And, of course, he's told me and he's told the police, if you try to get me to move, I'll just remove the blanket. Because I don't have to. They call that a display device. So you can't be there for more than an hour with a display device. But you can be there for as long as you want if you don't have a display device. I'll sit on the sidewalk if you insist. But so they've kind of ignored that. Anyway, tomorrow I encourage people to come on down. You can read more about this whole issue on indiebay.org/Santa Cruz, Santa Cruz Indie Media, and you can check out the story. Just Google for Shane Maxfield, ShaneMaxfield, or Lulu Carpenters is another thing you can just Google for. We have a caller. Let's see who's calling in here. This could be the call we're waiting for. Let's see who this is. Hi, you're on free radio. At least I thought you were on free radio. Try again, caller. Give a call again. 427-3772.
You zapped them.
I did not. Or 469-3119. Now, while we're waiting for the caller to call in, the issue that we're going to be talking about is medical marijuana and the county's policies. And that is something that actually Thomas Levitt on his Sunday show played a lengthy forum, which involved Ben Rice, who's the attorney who will be calling in, I hope. He talked about the county's medical marijuana policies. And if you want to kind of review that, you can go to the Huff website. Huff is Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom. It's huffsantacruz.org. You can hear that whole tape. You can hear that whole forum, which actually has had some significant consequences, or at least it seems to be at the same time, shortly after that forum was held in the law library in the basement of the county building, the whole management of the county building's law library changed. And you had a certain it was independent under board of directors. It now is, I believe, controlled by the courts. Alex Cavallo, the court administrator, now controls it. This resulted, as I understand it, in the resignation of Dolores, the law librarian. And she hasn't talked to me about why she has resigned, but there are some suggestions that they didn't like the Medical Marijuana Forum, and they wouldn't allow that kind of thing to happen again because the Medical Marijuana Forum pointed out that the county was prosecuting a medical marijuana provider, Roger Minch, who is a he ran a business called the Hemporium up in Felton, which provided medical marijuana to people with valid physician recommendations and or cards. And he's still facing a trial on November 15th, two trials actually, a trial that he was convicted in one trial on one charge, and that was overturned by the courts. I've talked about this earlier, but he's facing, 3 months later, they arrested him on exactly the same thing, felony transportation, cultivation, possession for sale of marijuana, felonies for selling medical marijuana. And I think it's really a serious topic, and I'm hoping that we can get some of the latest updates from Ben Rice. I also have some information that I was kind of checking up on in terms of the voters around the country and what's happened in terms of the voting situation on marijuana in the last election. And if I can just find this, I will tell you about it. This is from the Times Standard, which is a newspaper from goodness knows where, but I got it off the drug policy website. Though voters in three states rejected initiatives to amend state penalties on the use and possession of marijuana, many communities voted to make pot a low priority for their police departments. The National Organization for the Reform of the Marijuana Laws said voters in Santa Barbara, Santa Monica, and Santa Cruz voted to make marijuana the lowest priority for law enforcement for their communities.
Red light blinking.
I see that. Similar initiatives in Eureka Springs, Arkansas, and Missoula, Montana also passed. All right, let's see. We hopefully have a caller here. Hi, I think you're on free radio.
Hey, Robert, it's Ben Rice calling.
Hey, Ben. Good to hear you. I've just been reading over this article about how lowest priority for police department enforcement of possession of marijuana laws has passed not only the three cities in California, Santa Barbara, Santa Monica, and Santa Cruz, but also Eureka Springs, Arkansas, Missoula, Montana. Any reaction to that?
Well, it's about time, huh?
You can say that again. I've introduced this discussion earlier. I know. Have you been listening to the radio? Or?
Nope. I just got home from my 8-year-old's basketball game. So.
Hey, well, thank you for calling in and taking the time.
Sure.
Yeah, great. I've mentioned that you and I guess Alan Schlossberg were involved in a forum in the law library, which discussed in some detail the whole medical marijuana situation, both vis-a-vis the feds, the state, and the county. Is that accurate?
Well, it's Alan Hopper.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Of the local ACLU's drug policy reform group. And, that was a benefit for WAM and the law library, and we were at the Board of Supervisors chambers for about an hour and a half talking about the status of the law, and everything has gotten even more interesting as a result of Measure K passing, and also recently the 6th District Court of Appeal, which is the appellate district that we're in, reversing Roger Minch's earlier conviction for marijuana sales, saying that the judge in that case had messed up by not permitting Roger and his public defender who was representing him, not permitting them to argue to the jury that Roger was protected under the Medical Marijuana Program Act laws so that he could provide medical marijuana to patients.
Well, I understand Judge Stevens made that ruling because he felt somehow that when Minch was originally arrested in 2003, that was not the law or some such thing? Or was that the basis for that?
As you and probably most of your listeners know, in 1996, California started down this road with the passing of the Medical Marijuana laws, the Compassionate Use Act. And those laws described people's right to have, with a doctor's recommendation, medical marijuana, and to grow medical marijuana and use it. And it also said that you could have a caregiver legally possess and grow medical marijuana for someone that they were caring for.
How about sale and transport?
The problem with those laws that were passed in 1996 is they didn't address sales, and they didn't address transportation. And the court, you know, the way things work, you go through, people get arrested, they have their day in their local superior court, and then if they lose, then they appeal to the Court of Appeal. And all of the courts of appeals that were dealing with the questions about transportation or whether clubs could exist and other areas of this, so like what a caregiver is, all of those courts of appeals are very conservative courts generally, and they were reading the Compassionate Use Act very narrowly, and they weren't allowing people to make these kinds of claims that, hey, how else am I supposed to get my medicine home but by driving it? And the courts of appeals were saying things like, well, you know, if you have a reasonable amount, you don't have too much, then it's okay. But they were really being very, I think, unrealistic and reading the statutes very, very narrowly.
Of course, our man Roger Minch was not driving at all when he was arrested on both occasions for the earlier trial in 2005 and then for the current trial that he's got coming up, right?
Right. Well, the 2003 arrest was during, you know, that first go round of laws, but then everything changed as of 2004. January 2004, the legislature had finally, at the end of the preceding year, gotten together with people like Valerie Corral and others in the medical marijuana community and Vasconcelos and all these and folks from law enforcement, and everybody agreed the laws were too restrictive and needed to be clarified.
Mm-hmm.
And so then they passed what we call the Medical Marijuana Program Act, and that's a whole series of laws that were designed to explain and broaden the interpretation of those original laws.
AB 420?
That's right, AB 420. Uh-huh. And Judge Stevens thought incorrectly that he needed to apply the rules that existed at the time of Roger's arrest in 2003 instead of applying the new laws retroactively. And so he was wrong about that. And so now Roger's earlier conviction has been set aside, and the Court of Appeal, in a really great opinion for medical marijuana patients and their caregivers, said that, hey, wait a minute, these are questions for juries. It's not something for law enforcement or prosecutors or even judges to decide what a caregiver is, and to have, you know, sort of a line in the sand or a bright line which, really narrowly defines what a caregiver is. These are questions for juries, they said. They also said another question that's for a jury is what is reasonable compensation for someone like Mr. Minch? So this is a great case, but we've learned just in the last few days that the Attorney General's office has just filed a petition with the California Supreme Court asking them to look at that opinion, and they're hoping it'll be reversed.
So the Attorney General's office, and that's Jerry Brown's new position.
Jerry Brown's new position.
So we're saying that the once liberal, of course he wasn't the one who made this ruling because he wasn't in power at the time, but even Lockyer, I mean, is this based on, where does this all come from? Why are they appealing this, do you think?
Well, I think law enforcement, I know law enforcement and a lot of prosecutors are very upset because the language in Mr. Mensch's opinion gives new hope for people who want to have dispensaries and who want to have collectives, that they won't be bothered by law enforcement. And you know what? That's just inimical to these people. Many of them think that medical marijuana is all a bunch of baloney. If, for example, if your listeners care to look at the California Narcotics Officers Association website, they have a position paper. You can do a Google search for CNOA and get to their website. And virtually everybody that in law enforcement that does enforcement in medical marijuana or marijuana areas or drug areas are members of the California Narcotics Officers Association. They go to their trainings, and at their website you can read their position paper about medical marijuana, and they say it's all baloney. They say that it's just an excuse for recreational users to get their marijuana lawfully, which is outrageous, because we all know, and more Californians realize, and people around the country even now realize, that doctors ought to have the same ability and right, and the patients ought to have the same ability and right to use at their doctor's recommendation a drug as harmless as marijuana, just as they do with opiates and other real serious drugs that are prescribed day in and day out.
Well, you know, as far back as 1993, Proposition A was passed by Santa Cruz County, which recommended that medical marijuana be legalized. And we've had we've had a medical marijuana distribution center here. It was at Maple Street for 5 years. It was illegal, but it was, you know, it operated in the city. Now it can't be reopened because the city has these serious zoning restrictions that they refuse to change, even though Councilmember Rotkin has agreed to look them over. He never does. I continue to bring it up when he comes on the show, and he says, oh, yeah, sure, I'll look at that. You know, but the issue I guess I'm concerned about here with respect to Roger Minch is not so much that the feds and even the state attorney general are acting badly. Maybe you can expect that of them because they're under such pressure or they're in a conservative hands. But our own district attorney, Bob Lee, and our own sheriff, Robbins, not only did they go through the Minch trial once in 2005, after more than a year after SB 420 was passed, but they 3 months after... he was found not guilty on a number of the charges, he was found guilty on one charge, I believe, or two charges, and those were the charges appealed.
There were at least two. I don't have it in front of me. I didn't represent him in that trial. I'm representing him in his second case.
Right. Well, that second case is what concerns me, because 3 months later, in August, he was again arrested, essentially on the same charges, with the exception, I guess, of a gun nearby charge, which, you know, they threw in. And aren't they saying, and this is what you and I talked about as you passed by one day in the law library area of the courts, that they're saying that any distribution center, unless you are a direct caregiver, is somehow illegal, and this would make Greenway and the other club in Santa Cruz and every club in California, Santa Cruz in Oakland and San Francisco, illegal.
Well, that is their position, Robert. I've had this conversation with the sheriff, and you know, we certainly can't forget that Sheriff Robbins and Tracy before him have been sympathetic to a lot of medical marijuana claims, and it was under their watch that, you know, WAM has prospered, if you will, through the years and been blessed by these guys. And you know, I get upset with them because I think they're unrealistic about this notion that you can't have a dispensary. It makes no sense. And you know, I keep urging the county to take the steps that the city has taken, which is to come up with guidelines so that people like Mr. Minch, who really do want to do the right thing and provide a good quality medical marijuana to people who have recommendations and, you know, abide by the law, that they have the guidelines there in the county so that they can do that.
But the county has passed guidelines recently, right?
The guidelines the county passed,
right,
are guidelines about how much medical marijuana a person can have in their possession and how much they can grow. And as you know, the state of California said that a patient can have six female plants growing, or they can have 12, you know, unidentified plants growing, plants that haven't, you know, been found to be male or female yet, and they can have 8 ounces of marijuana bud. That doesn't include the leaf or the stems or the roots, just the flowers. But the county also said if somebody has a recommendation providing that they can have more than that, then they may.
Mm-hmm.
And they said that counties can come up with their own guidelines that are at least this generous. And if counties like Santa Cruz want to have more generous guidelines, they're free to do it. That was another thing that the Court of Appeal in Roger Mensch's case said, was Santa Cruz County guidelines were fine under the law. And our guidelines, there's only one other county that has as generous of guidelines as we do. And as I think you know, there's a patient in Santa Cruz can have up to 3 pounds of medical marijuana. And when growing their medicine, they can have up to a canopy area of 10 by 10. Now, that's a lot of medicine, but as many of, as you know, many people who have are being treated for cancer or AIDS or real serious medical problems smoke 3 joints a day, and that works out to 3 pounds in a year.
We're talking with Ben Rice, attorney for Roger Mensch and activist, and I think it's fair to call you fighting the drug prohibition war, opposing drug prohibition. Is that a fair position to label you with?
Well, I certainly am fighting on behalf of medical marijuana patients and for a rational approach to drug use in our society. I think that the drug war should have been called over many, many years ago. And, you know, I've been around long enough now. I've been a lawyer for 25 years, and I went through the 60s. I know that all that BS that they were saying to us in the 60s that, you know, if you touch a marijuana cigarette, you're going to wind up a heroin addict, is outrageous BS, and that the people that have been promoting those ideas are just full of crap. And it's just beyond me that we are only where we are now. But, I mean, that's consistent with our whole political world. It's just mind-boggling that we are so nutty in this country.
Well, what about, see, again, it's this county and the city that I kind of focus on, because there is where we may have some real power and some pressure.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering, I mean, we've talked about the county guidelines, you know, establishing a more generous quantity of marijuana which any particular patient or caregiver can have, but couldn't the county also specify to the Board of Supervisors that people could open distribution clubs, given the fact that it's authorized by is it SB or AB 420, you know, and also Proposition 215, and in essence put the sheriff's office and the DA on notice that the prosecutions of people like Roger Mensch are just out of bounds?
Well, yes.
They could do that.
The short answer is yes, and that's what I've been asking the county to do, the Board of Supervisors, to come up with, to look at the guidelines we've established and look at what's been happening around the state, because there's lots of evidence that the cities and counties that have come up with guidelines are finding that these are really helping people, and
now,
they are not creating more problems.
Has any county actually come up with a specific legalization of distribution clubs explicitly that you know of?
Sure, Santa Cruz, City of Santa Cruz. That is
the city of Santa Cruz, right?
The city of Santa Cruz,
right?
And the county of Los Angeles is just recently did this. And if you look, if your listeners look at the Americans for Safe Access website, there's a terrific, relatively very new actually pamphlet that they put out. It's more than a pamphlet; it's probably 30 pages. Of an argument for the creation of guidelines by cities and counties, and it talks about what different cities and counties have done and shows that it's been successful.
Isn't it kind of strange that the sheriff's office and the DA's office in a liberal county like ours is going after somebody like Roger mentioned, and that's one thing. And secondly, are other people also in Mensch's situation? Are you aware of other cases where individuals have, like Mensch, been arrested under the legal theory that you can't open a distribution center at all unless you are some sort of intimate WHAM-style collective caregiver?
Well, I am currently representing a number of people who have been growing for collectives and others who have been growing with the intent to sell to dispensaries. And in my view, they are protected under the law, and that's yet to be decided. But the great thing about the Mensch decision is that this is a jury question. For people in Santa Cruz, they're going to be the ones that tell law enforcement until our county supervisors pass some laws. It's going to be the juries who tell them, yeah, you know what, this is okay under the law for some for this collective to operate, or for this group of people
right.
to grow and provide to the dispensaries. How else are the dispensaries supposed to get their medicine?
Well, you've had the Mensch case, I take it, since around August of 2005.
Right.
You know, that's a year and 3 or 4 months, and during that time, the supervisors have had plenty of opportunity to clarify what Santa Cruz has done, to state, you know, it's inappropriate to arrest people for establishing distribution centers, as apparently is being done by the sheriff's office and being prosecuted by the district attorney's office. Why haven't they responded?
You know, I think that one of our big problems here is the county is still going after federal money to support
Bucks.
One district attorney position, and I think it's, I'm not sure if it's two or three law enforcement positions. That's the marijuana enforcement team. Those guys get grant money, and the DA's office gets a lawyer whose salary is paid for with this grant money. And so what, you know, it's like, what, you know, what are we thinking? Of course they're going to be anti-medical marijuana, and of course they're going to prosecute cases that should be prosecuted because, you know, they're all about, hey, getting busts, counting up the plants, counting up the arrests, and counting up the convictions, and then turning around the next year and saying to the feds, hey, look, we busted this many people and got these many plants. Send us some more money.
What's the remedy, Ben, for people listening to this broadcast who want to see the supervisors change this law or change this policy? Should they just call the Board of Supervisors and ask for a meeting with their supervisor? How can they express their opinion in a way that you think could be translated into action?
Well, I think that is a great way to do it, is to meet with your supervisor or send a letter. And, you know, they pay the most attention to letters that are typewritten, and if somebody's got a business or they can put a letterhead on it, and you know there are people that don't like to struggle through a handwritten letter. It's outrageous, but that's just carries more water in their minds when they get something from people who take the time and have access really to a typewriter or a word processing.
I suppose there's also an initiative process, such as, I think, Proposition A, our 1993 proposition urging marijuana be medically authorized in circumstances that people could use. Since the Board of Supervisors seems ill-disposed to do anything, and since people like Roger Mensch keep getting arrested, in spite of, I mean, it's very nice that they get the caregiver defense is available to a jury, but it's a tremendous expense, is it not, for someone like Mensch, even if you're donating your services pro bono, which I have no idea whether you are, you know, to go through these kinds of proceedings. I mean, it's pretty expensive, right?
Well, it's not only expensive, but it's just awful for people to be in that position, to have the fear of going to jail.
So how about an initiative?
I don't think that's a bad idea, Robert. I don't, you know, and another thing is the Board of Supervisors is not likely to act unless they think that the sheriff is going to support them.
Mm-hmm.
So if you know, people out there have connections with Sheriff Robbins, and and can influence them, you know, send him a letter. Just say, listen.
Let me put you on the spot, Ben. Would you be willing to write up an initiative that you feel contains the vital elements of this if there would be, I don't know if other people would be interested in supporting it, but that it's such an initiative I think should be out there as an option for people. And you sound like the kind of knowledgeable individual who would know about how to do this. I'm not just flattering you. You're obviously in the middle of this issue.
You know, I'd certainly consider working on that kind of an initiative. I've been proposing lately, since Rogers, the opinion came down from the 6th District, I've been proposing to law enforcement, a judge, the district attorney that handles these cases, and Arnie, a number of people, that we try and get a meeting with Sheriff Robbins, Val Corral, and some of the other folks that are involved with this stuff and have an interest in this, and see if we can't come up with some reasonable approach to this.
Well, you're a patient man to wait for doing this for 15 months. I myself would have lost patience very quickly, I'll tell you. I mean, it seems to me that they're not listening is my concern. Roger goes to another hearing on November 15th, is that right?
You know, I don't have my calendar in front of me. I think it is next week. I know.
I think it's the 15th.
I think you're right. I think that Roger and I are going to go in and withdraw his time waiver and set this for trial because the irony of the opinion coming down 2 weeks ago was it came down the week we were supposed to be trying his second case, and it was the trial was continued because the DA had a family emergency, and then 2 days later the opinion came out, which would have been wonderful if it had come out in the middle of his jury trial. So anyway, I don't want to wait to find out what happens in the Supreme Court.
That means he'll be tried within 60 days, is that right?
That's correct.
Yeah, because it's a felony case. Actually, 5 felony cases, right? And we're talking not just 5 felony cases. We're really talking a retrial, maybe 10 felony cases.
Well, they can't. They're not going to retry the first one now because that's on appeal.
Okay.
So we will try his second case, which is a single case with I think there's 5 counts. There's no gun. There was a gun in the first one, and there's no gun in this one. There's some ammunition that was left over from the previous arrest.
We're not talking about some Tommy gun and some aggressive weapon. We're talking about a weapon which was in a locked case, right, or such thing.
Even law enforcement agrees that all of the people that Roger was providing the medicine to had medical marijuana recommendations. All of them had legitimate needs and bases for those recommendations. It's just outrageous. Roger's really uniquely situated to be a caregiver for all these people because his girlfriend and another person that lives with them, they both are on some kind of disability and get money from the state. So Roger's a caregiver, even in the most restrictive reading of what a caregiver is, to the two of them. They both have recommendations. So he's home all the time anyway. He has a terrible back injury of his own, so he's a valid medical marijuana recipient, and he's a perfect guy to grow good medicine and to provide it with this handful of people in Santa Cruz County. And so, you know, they should let this go. But it's a real drag for people like Roger. I'm doing his case essentially pro bono, but I can only do a certain number of cases like that in a year. So
it's also
the most of the people end up having to pay money and deal with the...
It's also a drag for people who are concerned about having access to medical marijuana in the county because it not only stops... Roger, and it distracts. It stops those people who he was trying to serve. And as I understand it, even Judge Stevens, who found him guilty and denied the jury found him guilty, but who sentenced him and denied the caregiver defense improperly, said he could continue to sell and provide marijuana in spite of this conviction. And then 3 months later, they moved in again and took everything away from him. Search warranted his house, locked him up for a week.
Well, one of the things that we have the transcript from that sentencing, and Judge Stevens, Roger told probation before the sentencing hearing, and then he repeated it to the judge. He said, I'm going to continue to do this. And Judge Stevens gave him credit for time served when the DA wanted him to get 6 months in jail. Judge Stevens said, no, I'm giving you credit for the 3 days you've already served. And Mr. Mensch, he said, it's okay if you continue doing this. It won't be a violation of your probation, and it's not going to be a violation of law so long as you abide by the law.
Yet they're trying to violate his probation on this very thing, correct?
Well, yeah, but you know what? Stevens was just going, what are you guys doing? And the district attorney's office disqualified Judge Stevens from hearing the new case because they knew what his feelings were. I mean, Judge Stevens thinks this is all ridiculous, but he's also a guy that thinks he has to, you know, read the law, you know, the way he reads it and not bend it because of his personal beliefs. So,
can Rogers' probation be violated on this issue by who has the power here to violate Rogers' probation?
Well, the probation officer brings it to the judge's attention.
Which
and
judge?
The judge makes the decision.
It would be Judge Stevens?
Still Judge Stevens.
So it's unlikely his probation will be violated on this.
If he's convicted of the new case, well, let's just, you know, only assuming that the Sixth District is reversed, right? If they're reversed, then there could be he'd be on probation again for the first case, and then there theoretically could be a finding of violation of his probation, but if he was to be convicted of the new case. I just don't think that's going to have any bearing. The real issue is he going to be convicted in the new case? And I feel like we're in front of Judge Almquist. He's been terrific in the medical marijuana cases. I've had several with him, and he has been reading these statutes in the same fashion. Even before Mensch's first case was reversed, he's been reading it the same way that the Court of Appeal has been reading the statute.
But again, we're talking about allowing a caregiver defense, not simply throwing it out and saying, sorry,
right.
you can't go after a distribution center because of SB 420. We don't have people, in essence, upholding the law of the state of California at the moment.
Well, I brought a motion to dismiss in front of Judge Almquist, and before that, in front of Judge Barton, and they did not dismiss the case. So there's the short answer.
Thank you for that. That's useful information. I've been talking with Ben Rice. I'd love to talk to you for another half an hour on this one, Ben, but my time is up. How can people get more information on this issue?
Well, my website, benricelaw.com, WAM's website, WAM.org, the Americans for Safe Access, Indie Media has some stuff, and as does California Normal. Those are all resources people can take a look at.
Thanks, Ben, and I appreciate your taking the time to come on. Maybe we can grab you again soon to get more updates. I'd like to talk about the Irasenzu decision, too, which I think is an important case.
Irasenzu is an excellent case, and if people look at Roger Mensch's case, they can get the citation for the Irasenzu case, which is also very important. And
any final words to the community out there before we move on here?
Okay.
Hey, thank you for very much being with us.
Okay, thanks, Robert.
All right, man. Bye-bye. And that is it for Bathrop's Pierre's Broadsides. I'll be back on Sunday, and actually you can catch me tomorrow in front of Lulu Carpenter's between 4 and 8, where I will be urging people to sign a petition around the sleeping ban to stop the police merchant collusion against people on the streets, particularly disabled people, poor people who should be treated fairly. There should be a single standard of behavior towards poor people, and there shouldn't be laws that, in essence, give merchants the power to do whatever they want with people they don't like on the streets and public spaces. We're going to be urging a boycott of Lulu Carpenter's until such time as these issues are really addressed by the Downtown Association and by Manafri Srinath of Lulu Carpenter's, who's brought these issues to a head. And I want to thank Gregarious Greg for his long silence during the Ben Rice interview. If you want to review the Ben Rice interview, you can go to www.huffsantacruz.org. And it won't be coming on for a couple more days. It takes a couple days for these things to archive. But just then click on the name of our show, which is Bathrobes Pierre's Broadsides. I warn you, however, that you will soon be hearing lots of weird and crazy music from the the massive tool base of our latest control freak talk show host, Uncle Dennis.
I'm not the talk show host.
He's very, very clear about that. He's here. So you've got some 3 hours of music coming up. Thanks for being with me on this edition of Bathrobes, Piers, Broadsides. Come on down tomorrow, and we will cut the shit and get out of here, and hopefully Lulu Carpenters will cut the shit, too. Thanks again.
Very good, Robert.
Meet him tonight. I said, when I get low, oh, I get high. All this hard luck in this town has found me. Nobody knows how trouble goes round and round me. Oh, I'm all alone with no one to pet me. But old rocking chair ain't never gonna get me, 'cause when I get low, oh, I get high.
From the cream to the dregs with Uncle Dennis, sitting here in the nice warm chair. Thank you very much, Robert. On a Thursday night, we're going to be getting off in here to the From the Cream to the Dregs weekly exploration of the music of the 60s and 70s. And tonight we're going to have a little studio and transmitter maintenance going on during the first hour, so there may be some outages in the stream at various times, but anyway, I will be here, and we'll be on the air for you right here at Free Radio Santa Cruz 101.1, www.freakradio.org. Robert will be back on Sunday morning at 09:30 for more of his brand of activism here on Free Radio. For now, just sit back and enjoy the Allman Brothers. This one's called Mountain Jam. As I mentioned before, Free Radio Santa Cruz will be undergoing maintenance for the next few minutes. So if we are off the air, we'll be back. Stay tuned. System maintenance is happening. Not technical difficulties, technical improvements. So stand by. Cream to the Dregs will return shortly.